You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
We're very fortunate to have Professor Deirdre McCloskey, who will be our next speaker. She, in many ways, doesn't need any introduction to this group, but I'll give a short one, which is that she is a distinguished professor emerita from the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle. She is also a
At Chicago. It turned out to be a bad idea to name your university after a traffic intersection.
Okay. That's a good correction. And I'll come back to that, her corrections, in a second. But she's also a distinguished fellow of our Hayek program here, and has visited with us several times and provided wisdom, insight, and guidance as we have tried to develop the program over these last 10 years. As you all know, Professor McCloskey produced this one of perhaps the most sustained effort at understanding the modern economic growth in her Bourgeois Trilogy. She's also written a series of books, most recently on liberalism, which are highly recommended. And she also now has a new set of books on not only bettering humanomics, but also beyond positivism and sort of neo-institutionalism and all of those things. And on that point, I will point out that she is nearly always correct in her criticism of the encroaching influence of neo-institutionalism on our thought. So with that, I will turn it over to Deirdre, and please join me in welcoming Professor McCloskey.
Thank you very much. We're partly beyond COVID, but we were masked all this time, so we didn't get colds. So now I have the worst cold I've had in 3 years. So you'll pardon me if I blow my nose disgustingly every once in a while. In the 1980s, Aryo Klammer and I started to think about the rhetoric of economics, how economists profess to speak to each other, and how they actually do. And Aryo caught on a lot quicker than I did to the truth that it's true in the economy too. It's not only in academic economics that models and metaphors, facts and stories, values matter, but in the economy itself. Now look, the sociologists and anthropologists here will say, uh-huh, you finally caught on to that. And yes, and many of the political scientists too. But okay, we're slow in economics. I admit that. So I wanted to tell you how that program evolved and how it came to be what Bart Wilson at Chapman first called humanomics. He and Vernon Smith have written a book of that title, So Have I. And I hope there will be a lot of books with humanomics in the title, because that's where economics should go. It's very much, as Vernon stresses, I just saw him last night in California at a wedding, going back to the other Smith, Adam Smith, who invented economics, though with very considerable French influence at the time, but also invented social psychology in his more original book that everyone here should read, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Now, the central empirical question to be answered, or the central fact, for a while I was calling it the great fact, but now I've decided to just call it the great enrichment, is that since 1776, let's choose that as an important date in the history of the world, income per head in countries that have adopted liberal economic policies of one sort or another has increased by a factor of 30. 30. I talked about this some years ago to the cultural anthropologists at Cambridge University. And one very distinguished anthropologist got, you know, anthropologists are not too quantitative. He got up and said, well, I really think you're right about this factor of 30. My studies of other societies have shown that. But then you keep saying 3,000%, and that's too big. I didn't say, dear, you've forgotten your fourth grade arithmetic. But still, it's 3,000%. And this is completely unprecedented. It's the second most important secular event in human history. As an Anglican, I have another candidate for the non-secular event, but the most important secular event in human history is the invention in 9 different parts of the world of agriculture, which allowed cities and writing and all kinds of other things. But the second most important event is one that we're in the middle of, the great enrichment of the world, which within the lifetime of the younger people here, I guess it'd have to be, well, the younger people, bids fair to eliminate world poverty, essentially. Take the case of China, which on the death of Mao was unspeakably poor, $2 a day, maybe $3 a day. Imagine trying to live in Northern Virginia on $3 a day. You couldn't even buy a cappuccino. And yet now, this part of the world, it's upwards of $200 a day. And in China, it went from $2 a day to what they claim is a little, you can't be sure about Chinese statistics, but it's about equal to the world average, which nowadays, going from $2 a day, 1776 for a world average, is now about $50 a day. What it was in the United States when I was born in 1942. All right, so factor of 30, unprecedented completely. A big bang, you might say. Why? Pourquoi? The answer is liberalism. That's my claim. That it's the liberal idea which does not have deep European roots. It's not the case that it's Christianity that caused liberalism or weirdness or whatever, all this kind of, let's see if we can find it in the 9th century stuff. It's confined really to the long 18th century. That's when liberalism, the theory that there should be no masters, first emerged among intellectuals like Adam Smith, among French intellectuals like Turgot, and then became briefly the dominant thought in Britain, especially in the early 19th century, about policy, a word, by the way, that didn't exist in English and barely in French until the 19th century. The age of policy in economics is about 100 years old, and in the wider iteration of economic governance, about 200 years old. So that's my claim, that it's liberalism that made us rich, not state action. What's liberalism? Well, I just said, it's the absence of masters. In the 1880s, a naive European visitor somehow got to the Powder River Valley in Montana. I mean, how he got there without getting this straight, I don't know, but he got there, boom. He was in the Powder River Valley in Montana. And he comes up to a cowboy and he says, as a European naturally would, "Who is your master? Who is your master?" And the cowboy said, "He ain't been born yet." And that characteristically American insolence towards hierarchy is the core of liberalism. Hierarchy, naturalized hierarchy. Aristotle said, some people are born to be slaves. Everyone said, at least all the men did, that women are naturally inferior to men. Every white person said that black, at least started to say, it's a rather new phenomenon, but started to say, all black people are inferior to white people. That kind of hierarchy was challenged by Tom Jefferson. All men and women, dear, are created equal, except his children by Sally Hemings, who he didn't liberate. Even Ben Franklin owned slaves, by the way. He brought two slaves in his long sojourn in London. One of them ran away, as under English law after 1782, you were perfectly entitled to do. And the other one stayed with him and went back to Philadelphia. So with that, with those embarrassing exceptions in the New World and in the Old, this idea of masterless societies came to be. Hierarchy tilted and collapsed. And the first great achievements of liberalism were, of course, indeed the abolition of slavery and serfdom. And eventually, women's rights, colonial people's rights, gay people's rights, etc. So, the state, as Max Weber wrote in 1919, is the legitimate exercise of coercion in a certain area. The state does coercion, that's its job. And most of the people here are not anarchists, I'm certainly not. But although we view them with sisterly affection, but the state is about coercion. Sometimes necessary, sometimes largely, I'd say, not. Whereas the rest of the society is about conversation, Ario's word. Mine is sweet talk. About this rhetoric that we engage in as human beings. So liberalism was essential, necessary to the making of the modern world. One mental experiment you can do to convince yourself of this occurred to me only the other day, which is imagine the modern world without liberalism. Imagine the modern world consisting of Putin and Trump and Bolsonaro, you Brazilians here, I'm sorry to say, you got to vote for Lula. Imagine the world without this movement from the 18th century on. It would be a nightmare, an Orwellian nightmare. O'Brien, the party man, in 1984, said to the hero of the book, when he had him in custody, he said, if you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Hierarchy, nationalized hierarchy, is that. It's a boot stamping on the human face forever. It comes with agriculture, that first important, most important event, a secular event in human history, yielded masters and servants. You can read about them in the Hebrew Bible, which, by the way, made the argument of the Southern slave owners before the Civil War the better argument in a Christian society, because all the whole of the Old and New Testament were filled with slaves and hierarchy. So it's necessary. But I would claim also, as an economic historian, that it was sufficient in the sense that you drop this into the usual array of social organizations, property rights, rule of law, the absence of a war of all against all, and you get an explosion of economic growth. So what I mean by saying that these conditions, these other conditions, these other necessary conditions are just there, is that they are. A society that doesn't have rule of law is not a society at all. It's a bunch of gangsters fighting with each other. But a society of what? Equality of permission, which is another way of thinking about what liberalism is quite different from the naturalized hierarchy of an agricultural society. It's not equality of opportunity, as we often, I think, intellectually, lazily think. Equality of opportunity is unattainable. It can't be compensated with lump sum transfers. If you had bad parents, you're stuck with that. I was talking last night in Los Angeles to a woman, I won't tell who she is, who's been alienated from her parents because her father abused her sexually when she was a girl and her mother didn't protect her from it. Well, how are you going to equalize that opportunity? Now, if you're in Sparta in ancient times, you take the children away from their parents when they're 6 years old, both men and girls and boys, and you educate them to be the Spartanate, at least the boys, in a uniform way that gives them all the chance to sacrifice themselves at Thermopylae. But in a free society, in a minimally free society, you can't have equality of opportunity. We can fix it, and I'm very willing to be taxed a little bit to pay for elementary education and the common defense against, well, my big fear is the Canadians. If they want Northern Maine, they can have it, but I draw the line at Portland. But equality of permission, allowing women to be airline pilots if they want. I'm always a little startled when a female voice comes on and says, "Hello, this is Jane Smith, the captain." But go girl, you go girl is my attitude. And equality of permission we can achieve tomorrow by just taking away all the lacks of permission built into the laws, such as famously the law against corn rowing as a occupation unless you've been to cosmetology school for 2 years. Now, the argument is that it was sufficient, that it caused, as the English say, you know, the English have invented more sports than you can count. It's just astounding how many sports have been at least codified by the English and sometimes invented whole hog, like my favorite, which is cricket. Keep a straight bat and watch out for the googlies. That there are very few people in this room who will get that joke. And the English liberal idea was to let people have a go. It's a sporting metaphor. You get your innings, and then I get mine, and then you get yours, and so on. When Boris Becker, German, won Wimbledon, he said he came up to Margaret Thatcher, who was the prime minister then, who was there, said, "Vel," in a thick German accent, I won't make fun of his accent, but, "Vel, how does it feel for a German to defeat you in your national game, lawn tennis?" And she replied, "I seem to remember we beat you at your national game twice." So games are what the English, and more widely the Scots too, do. And they let people have a go. And go they did. There's a lot of economic research to be done, sociological research to be done on how this actually happened in detail. But I'm persuaded that giving people equality of permission was tremendously inspiriting. Who's your master? He ain't been born yet. That's what came out of it. And then what immediately came out of it is what I call innovism, which is the economic system of what we usually call capitalism. Capitalism is just about the worst scientific word I know. You know, ether, it's really a, or the humors, the four humors and the elements of earth, fire, water, and air. Come on. Capitalism is a terrible word. It's very misleading scientifically, coined by the enemies of free societies. Not actually Marx himself, but his followers. So innovism is what we should call what happened in the last couple of centuries. Humans always innovated. You know, they invented the bow and arrow. They invented the wheel. They invented horse riding and so forth. So they always invented stuff, but they had invented it too slowly to prevent Malthusian logic from taking over and keeping them down at $2 a day. After 1776, the rate of innovation went up by a factor of 10. And more or less at the time that Malthus wrote the principles of population in 1798, it stopped applying. So now the kind of ghostly echo of Malthus that many of us have in our mind, that population growth is really a big problem. We've really got to do something about it, like compulsorily sterilizing lots of women, has no scientific base. It's innovation that made the modern world. So it's, I say that the usual explanations that we hear in neo-institutionalism and other fashions in modern economics are very unpersuasive. The idea that in 1689 English law suddenly wasn't extractive and core is just ridiculous. English law, in a famous phrase, was pretty much drawn up before the time of Edward I. That is before 1273. It's not the case that foreign trade made Britain rich. It's not the case that empire made Europeans rich, in which case Austria-Hungary, which didn't have overseas empire colonies, would have been poorer than its neighbors, and it wasn't the case. It's not the case that these static gains were crucial. Now, there are lots of economists here, people who've had an economics course, so I'm going to draw a diagram. I put, food on the vertical axis and all other goods on the other axis. So we have two goods in the world. And I'm going to draw the per capita production possibility curve of Britain in 1776. I told you where it is. I'll go behind it, go behind the diagram now here. And behind it, here it is. What, see, you can see it. You come on, use your imagination. And the British per capita production possibility curve is this. Now watch, you have to watch very closely or you miss it. It goes. It's out here way in the corner. Way in the corner, little teeny production possibility curve. And if you trade, you can get outside it. Well, about half an inch outside it. And if there's unemployment, you're inside the production's little teeny weensy production possibility curve, and you can move to the production. Oh boy, static gains, wow. What actually happened in the next two centuries was that the production possibility curve on these same axes moved out to here. Factor of 30, more even. So static models are not how to go. And we can't get away from it. We economists can't, because it's really easy to teach static models. I've written whole books in praise of them. And I, you know, you want to learn economics, read my old price theory book. You get all the static arguments. But that's not what made the modern world. What made the modern world is the releasing of human creativity to more and more people. First, poor English men, then chattel slaves, then women, etc., etc. All right, so that is to say, the modern world was achieved by individual, organizational, corporate action, not by state action. Now, this is a deep sort of disagreement with our statist friends. I don't hate my socialist friends. I was a socialist once. I see the attraction. Arise, ye prisoners of starvation. I know more socialist songs than anyone here, I'll bet. Because in my brief period of socialism, I was a folky and learned all the songs. The people's flag is deepest red. It sheltered oft our martyred dead. It witnessed many a deed and vow. We must not change its color now. Oh, I wish there were libertarian songs as good as that. Work on it. So most state actions reduced economic growth, sometimes spectacularly. All you have to do is look at East and West Germany in the old days, we want current example, obviously, North or South Korea. It's not state action, although people love to say this. Partly because, very quite innocently, they notice there are poor people. And they say, well, let's bring them into the family. Let's make the nation into a great big family of 335 million people, say. This was articulated in 1927 in the Swedish parliament as the national home, as the ideal for Swedish politics. And the problem, of course, is that although among friends, as Erasmus said, all goods are common, if that is used among large groups, it doesn't work. St. Paul himself, in his letter to the Thessalonians, said, he who does not work should not eat. St. Paul was really tough. And that's how it has to be, or the society doesn't work very well. And the state can't solve it. Now look, our friends, and I, as I say, I have lots of friends who are statists. They believe a false syllogism. They believe, first of all, that we're all gormless idiots. Everyone in this room has 240 cognitive biases that make it incredible that we can walk across the street without getting killed. Axiom number one. Axiom number two. The market, or voluntary human action, or concentric circles, or the humane economy that Arya talks about, can't solve it. We can't figure it out with cooperative arrangements of various sorts. We're too damn stupid. To put it another way, the market has many, many imperfections. You get this immediately when you make a laissez-faire argument with your friend, the statist. The first thing she says is, oh, but markets are imperfect. I did a paper some years ago for an Italian journal where I counted 108 imperfections that economists have proposed since 1848. The way you get famous in economics is to think up a new imperfection. And in modern times, you get a Nobel Prize for it. You don't have to offer any evidence that it's actually true. This is a shocking feature of modern economics. You don't have to show how important informational asymmetries are, although why this is news, I don't know. Many of us here are in the business, the academic business, of overcoming informational asymmetries. That's what we do when we teach kids. But anyway, no one has shown that externalities of various sorts are crippling to an economy. I give the example in the paper of monopoly. Enterprise monopoly is against state-sponsored monopoly, which is the real kind, but enterprise monopoly, which is the boogeyman on the left, corporate power. Ooey, ooey, scary music. Ooey, corporate power. When standing right there is this enormous leviathan that really is powerful. The recent book by Acemoglu and Robinson is in praise of the leviathan. And I say, no, no, dears. Look at the leviathan. Look at how dangerous and big that is. The shoe companies are just trying to sell you shoes. And if you don't like their shoes, you can move away. And I argue in this paper that really, historically speaking, since 1776 or 1800, enterprise monopoly has steadily declined, mainly because of falling transport costs and transactions cost. The internet reduces the local monopoly that might occur in your neighborhood. The invention of the bicycle, the invention and the cheapening of bicycles, made bicycles that had once been a rich young man's toy into the tool of equalization of the condition of the working class. The railways, the telephone, let your fingers do the walking, and so forth. So it's an empirical scandal in economics that this big premise that the market is so imperfect that it can't fix your idiocy is just left hanging. And then, of course, there's the corresponding belief, inconsistent with the first two, that government is perfect. I'm not here to attack government employees. I've got my whole family on my father's side works for the CIA. We're not exactly clear what Annie does, but we think she runs all the spies in Europe. You know, Uncle Don, my father's brother, he'd go to Beirut or Pakistan, and the next year there'd be a revolution. Maybe Uncle Don had something to do with it. So I'm not attacking these people. They're my cousins, my friends. But the structure of statism is to assume that they know when they can't possibly know. As Hayek said, knowledge is distributed in the society. And as I've said, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? That's a joke, but it's a serious joke and can be a challenge to every person who thinks in terms of a policy that's going to fix these terrible 108, I counted them, imperfections. Meanwhile, this highly imperfect economy increased income by a factor of 30. With such imperfections, who needs perfections, to adopt Yiddish syntax? So, okay, the age of policy is upon us. For the last 100 years, in increasing volume, increasing sort of a kind of madness, economists have thought that their job is to think up new policies to be implemented by the state coercively. Now, the other social sciences don't do this. Anthropologists would be appalled if, as was true of the origin of their field, they were actually agents of European imperialism, trying to figure out how to keep the EBGB in subalternship. So anthropologists don't do it. Sociologists don't, substantially. They just say, well, look, here are some networks. Sociologists love networks. They don't actually tell why they have any effect, but they do love to draw these little diagrams. And the political scientists, especially the theorists, like to talk about income distribution as though it had nothing to do with production. This is a point that Dave Schmitz has made in a recent book. So the age of policy is upon us, and it needs to stop. It's scientifically silly. It's arrogant. It's immoral. It's unethical to think you know better for an adult. For your kid, definitely. If the boy is proposing to run in front of a tram, use coercion to stop him. I'm all for it. But the core of liberalism is to let, as Adam Smith said, to let each person find his way, live his life as he wishes. Now look, I'm a Christian liberal. I'm an Anglican. My Anglican God is a black, overweight, working class, middle-aged, lesbian, single mother who works in the grocery store in Leeds. So get ready. She's not an old man in a beard. It's going to be quite a shock when you meet her. And so I'm a Christian liberal. I believe that we owe an obligation to the wretched of the earth. But the obligation we mainly owe is to let them stop being wretched. And that happens in a free society. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.